Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
I'm Carrie Miller. This is NPR News. Michael Donker's new novel has a glossary on the first page that features words like ampa and agu. I'm sure I'm mispronouncing them. They're expressions and phrases from Twi, a dialect of the Akan language spoken in southern and central Ghana, and they pepper the dialogue of his debut novel. Donker himself is Ghanaian, and he says the idea for the novel began when he realized something was missing from the stories that African-born writers were telling. Michael Donker's novel is titled House Girl, and he joins us today from London. And Michael, welcome. It's good to have you on the show.
Hi there. Thank you so much for having me.
Hey, thank you for the glossary. The characters in the novel slip rather seamlessly between British English. Is it Twi? Am I pronouncing that right?
That's right. That's perfect. Yeah.
They seem to use Twi when they're being most emotional or sensitive or passionate with one another. I mean, in the community in London, do you hear this kind of seamless intermixing of these languages?
Absolutely. And actually, that aspect of the dialogue was really influenced by listening to and thinking about the way that my mum speaks. My mother was born in Ghana in the mid-40s and grew up speaking English and Twi. And when she was raising me in London, whenever I'd hear her speaking to Ghanaian friends, she'd move very easily between the two languages without there being any kind of awkwardness or really kind of acknowledging what she was doing. So it felt very kind of real to me, that kind of fluidity and that ease of movement between these two different ways of speaking and thinking as well, I guess.
If she was speaking to you in Twi, did you know it was serious or particularly intimate or, you know, close? Or did it signal anything to you?
Interestingly, I don't speak Twi. So my mum, no, I don't. So my mum made this rather bold decision with me and my sisters when we were growing up that she wouldn't teach us Twi, because her thought was that we would become confused when we were trying to learn two languages at the same time. And it's not uncommon, actually. If you speak to lots of British Ghanaians of my generation, there are a whole kind of swathe of us who can't speak Twi very well at all. So the Twi that's in the book is the kind of the Twi that I know. It's everything that I've got, basically.
That is so interesting.
Yeah.
I mean, and do you feel that you missed something from that?
I do. Yeah, I do. And I think sometimes I wonder whether it was my mum and my dad's way of kind of preserving something of themselves in a way that we as children wouldn't have access to, because there was this whole bit of their lives shrouded in this language that we can understand. And it's made things tricky in terms of my feeling completely at home when I'm in Ghana, because although English is very widely spoken and I'm, you know, completely understood and I can talk to people and move around very freely, when people do speak Twi, this wall is suddenly erected between me and the world around me. And, you know, I suddenly feel very infantilized because I can't do anything. I can't participate in any way. I just sort of have to sit and wait for someone to, you know, tell me where the toilet is or show me the way to the airport or whatever it might be. So it is frustrating, but it does also in some ways come with, there are sort of benefits for a writer, because that sort of exclusion that I endure when I can't speak to you and, you know, everyone else is getting on with their uproarious conversations, that kind of distance that I'm placed at gives me a kind of objectivity, I suppose, to kind of look at this world and this country slightly differently. So go on.
So you've been going back to Ghana since you were a child. Is that right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
But I wonder now, hearing what you've said about the language and how your mother thought about that, is writing a novel about, you know, a culture, yes, transplanted to London, to a place that you're very familiar with, but about a culture and, by the way, a gender. This is about young girls. Did that feel precarious to you?
I think there were aspects of that bit of the writing that were kind of intimidating, I guess. I think the kind of idea of, you know, misrepresenting or kind of offending Ghanaians by not presenting them with a version of their country that they found recognisable initially was something that I was really concerned with. But actually, the more I wrote the novel and the more confident I became in my abilities as a writer and in the kind of authenticity of the project, I realised that actually saying some things that were quite critical about Ghanaian culture and that would make the novel seem actually quite unrecognisable to some Ghanaians was a really important thing to do. So whilst I was sort of trying in one way to kind of capture the country authentically, I didn't want to feel like slavishly attached to a particular version of Ghana. I needed to say some things about Ghana that were probably a bit uncomfortable for some readers to hear. And I think in terms of the gender issue, maybe rather kind of blithely, I just didn't think about it at all. I was not concerned that I was writing the experiences of three young women at all. And I'm glad that I sort of adopted that approach, because I think if I had been very nervously thinking, oh gosh, I've got to make sure that this sounds really authentically womanly, I think I would have shoehorned in all sorts of quite weird, trite references that female readers would have found really irritating, to be honest.
I don't want to let go though for a minute of what you just said about you felt it was important for you to be able to say what you wanted to say, and that
some of
that might be critical about Ghanaian society. You know, there are writers who take a lot of heat for opening outside eyes to a culture, you know, to the things that they understand about a culture. I mean, there are people within that culture that say, we only get so much attention. Why do you have to show that about us?
Yeah, and it's been really interesting, actually, in various interviews that I've done in the promotion for this novel, that sort of idea has been presented to me a few times that, you know, we should be presenting a positive image of blackness. We should be sort of putting the best version of Ghana forward for the world to look at. And I sort of understand that way of thinking, but equally, I think if we are minded to make Ghanaian culture the best that it can be, that sometimes means listening to quite difficult truths about yourself. And so this isn't about sort of slating Ghanaians. It isn't about saying, oh God, it's terrible. What an awful way of living and what an awful country. It's about saying, this is where we are at the moment. And here are some fantastic things about being Ghanaian and some fantastic things about Ghana as a country. But there are significant places in which we need to kind of improve and move forward if we're to be the best that we can be. It's uncomfortable, but hopefully from that discomfort arises something better. That's sort of my thinking about it, really.
I think that this is what literature can do in a way that journalism, and as a journalist, I have a clear-eyed view about this. Literature can say and do things that journalism cannot about the world that we're living in. And sometimes the writer that, you know, is taking that on is going to be either misunderstood or harshly criticized for it. But that's the value of literature. I know you teach literature, right?
I do. And I completely agree with that perspective. I think literature has a really unique ability to be able to present challenging, often quite difficult, complicated ideas without being too hectoring and too kind of obvious, and leaving people enough space to kind of think about the ideas that are being presented and to interpret freely and in their own way and come to their own conclusions. And that was something that I was really keen to achieve in the novel. As much as I, you know, have kind of particular issues that I kind of wanted to raise in the novel, there's also, I hope, enough room for people to be able to think, well, this is what this novel is suggesting, but actually I look at things slightly differently. I didn't want to write a novel that was didactic at all. It was meant to be a novel that started conversations. That was the thinking behind it.
Michael Doncor is with us if you've just tuned in. We're talking about his new novel, House Girl. He's one of the young writers in Britain to watch. The novel is terrific. You can read more about it on The Thread. The story follows a young woman, Belinda, who is taken from her job as a maid in a wealthy household in Ghana to London. And she is expected to be a good influence on the spoiled daughter of this wealthy household. And I know this is deliberate. It is unclear to me as to whether Belinda is the hired help, whether she's a member of the family. And I think you left that deliberately ambiguous, did you?
I did. I think there's lots of complexity surrounding that aspect of the novel. I think one of the things to kind of consider is that Belinda is so obedient and has been so inculcated with this idea that she must serve, that when she's put into a new situation where there's all sorts of opportunities for her to do things beyond serving, she doesn't really know how to take advantage of those opportunities. She can't really operate in any other way. But there's, you know, there's an added layer there in that fairly early on in the novel, Nana and Doctor, Belinda's new hosts, if you like, say to her very explicitly that she's been brought over to London to better herself in terms of education. But it's not clear, and as you say, it's deliberately left ambiguous whether that's really what they want or whether they're actually quite, you know, pleased that they've got an extra pair of hands to keep the house clean. And I think that often in these situations in British Ghanaian families where relatives come over from Ghana and are staying with Ghanaian families for a short or long period of time, often the role that the kind of guest, in inverted commas, occupies is never really made clear, and it's very difficult for that guest who is sort of newly arrived and vulnerable and uncertain to kind of clearly say, oh, I'm not going to clean your house because that's not what I'm here to do. So it's a really interesting dynamic, I think.
Yeah, I mean, I saw Belinda as kind of a poignant accessory to this ama, to this spoiled girl's upbringing. And there's this moment in the novel where Belinda and Amma, the two girls, are talking about how much Amma's mother loves her. And Belinda, of course, the outsider, the person who's been brought over to influence Amma to be a better person, thinks to herself, the fact that Nana had brought her over from Ghana to London mostly for Amma's benefit, mostly in the hope of soothing and fixing Amma, was to Belinda a big obvious example of the care that Amma was blind to. It's also an example that, you've just said this, Belinda doesn't, she's so indoctrinated with this idea that she is here to serve that she never thinks what many of us would think is, why am I the person who has to do this? Why doesn't she realize what she has here?
Yeah, absolutely. And that sort of element of Belinda's character where she doesn't kind of act on those feelings, those sort of understandable feelings of rage that any of the rest of us might have in this situation, was something that really fascinated me about her as a character, the kind of level of self-control and self-repression that she often shows in those situations, I just thought was really kind of compelling. And something that I think lots of Ghanaian girls sort of experience the whole time. There is a real kind of sense in Ghana, I think, that young girls should be compliant, that they should follow rules, that sort of expressing your opinions really openly in a kind of, inverted commas, masculine way is just not appropriate and can lead to all sorts of trouble. So I was sort of trying to tap into that sort of aspect of Ghanaian patriarchal thinking in Belinda's, like, sort of holding herself together and silencing herself in that way.
And of course, the conflict comes when families emigrate somewhere like London or the United States, right? And meet a culture that says, boys speak out, girls speak out.
Absolutely.
I didn't know much about that.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think one of the kind of central tensions in the novel is that Belinda finds herself in this British culture, which is encouraging her in all sorts of ways to kind of be more vocal and to be more expressive. But again, she doesn't really know how to deal with that opportunity. And it's frightening to her. It's really frightening to her. She doesn't really have the tools to kind of be that sort of person. And yet she finds it quite appealing and attractive. Particularly when she sees that when Amma kind of is sort of open, it's sort of fun and exciting. But it's unsettling too. So Belinda has an awful lot of things to be wrestling with when she's in London.
Do you think there is something in what you've just described unique to the Ghanaian culture or maybe some of the African cultures that people who are emigrating from other places in the world, you know, don't confront that?
I don't know. I think there are similarities between the kinds of issues that Belinda confronts and other immigrant narratives. I think that experience of having to kind of assimilate very quickly and not quite knowing how to do that. I think the experience of sort of trying to fit yourself into a new world, I think the idea of outsiderhood, I think all of those things are things that lots of different kinds of immigrants struggle with, essentially. I suppose something that might be in some ways unique to the Ghanaian experience is the kind of particular brand of, well, two things, I suppose, kind of Ghanaian conservatism, which we've talked about a bit already, and that idea that there are very conventional social rules that you have to adhere to. And I suppose also the kind of very fearsome West African, because I think Nigerian shares as well, belief in kind of self-betterment and the power of education. And so when Belinda comes over, she's quite proud of the schooling that she does have. And when she's told that she's going to go to school, and there are lots of chapters when she's getting qualifications in English language and literature, that really matters to her. And anything that sort of impedes on her lesson sometimes really frustrates her, because this is a really, really central part of the kind of African immigrant story, that you can make a place for yourself in this often alienating new society that you found yourself in by increasing your knowledge and increasing your education.
You used the phrase assimilation a minute ago. Here in the States, we've been having a long and sustained and often fractious debate about what assimilation is. And what we find is people, you bring a lot of, you know, different perspectives and interpretations to the idea of assimilation. I assume that's also being debated in Britain.
I think it is. I think we are having a very difficult time at the moment in terms of thinking about how fantastically enriched our culture and society are by the people who have come here from all over the world, and also developing a really quite frightening small islander mentality where we want to kind of close ourselves off from everyone in the world. So I think Britain is sort of tearing itself apart a little bit trying to answer those questions. And I think, you know, for me personally, you know, I live in the middle of London. I have taught at a variety of very multicultural schools. I think that immigration has brought only fantastic things to this country. And I'm very well aware that there are bits of the country that haven't seen the same kind of economic and cultural benefits of immigration that we feel in London. But I think it's the duty of our government to make sure that those benefits are equally distributed, not to kind of just decide, okay, well, we're going to turn our back on the rest of the world and decide that we're going to become this monocultural little island. So I'm, you know, a very big fan of immigration. We need more of it, not less of it, I think.
I hear you on that. I guess I was asking more about this idea of the different perspectives that people bring to the idea of when you're assimilated, which in this country is, you know, there's an argument about you can call yourself, and I'm being reductive here, but you can call yourself an American when. And, you know, some of it's language. Some of it's when you live in a way that, you know, looks more, when you get a high school. I mean, there's just so many different interpretations of when you or we, which is really where the fractiousness comes in, when we decide that you're assimilated. And I think I hear that going on in Britain, too, you know, within the immigration debate.
Yeah, I think you're right. It is happening. I think one of the big problems in that discussion, and it is related to the thing I was saying earlier, is that there's a sort of muddiness about what it actually means to be British.
Yeah.
We don't, I think even people who are born in Britain, who are natively British, whatever that might mean, would find it very difficult to define what this thing is that people are supposed to be assimilating into. You know, so there's a sort of there's a citizenship test that people have to do now to kind of prove their Britishness. And the questions that are asked on those citizenship tests would not be able to be accurately answered by lots of natively British people. So I think that question of assimilation is really difficult to unpick, because Britishness is such a kind of flexible concept, I think.
Are you still teaching at a girls' school?
I am, yes. Yeah.
So, and are you teaching a curriculum of what, world literature or British literature? Or what kinds of books and stories are these girls reading?
Well, this is something that often frustrates me, actually. I feel like the curriculum is distressingly white and male. Mm-hmm. And I spend a lot of time and exert a lot of energy in finding little ways of kind of slipping in sort of contraband extracts from other kinds of writers.
Like what? Give me an example.
So I love Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie, mm-hmm. Who I think I described to someone once as being the sort of like gatekeeper or permission giver for me. She enabled me to write this novel and to think about myself as a writer. So I often try and get in little bits of Adichie's short stories.
I would hope so. I mean, that it's a subversive act to get Adichie onto the reading list.
Yeah,
come on.
Yeah. Mm. Well, when, you know, the sort of standard fodder is, you know, Dickens, Adichie looks kind of pretty rebellious in comparison to that. I try very hard to make sure that the girls that I'm teaching are aware that there's a whole other range of writers out there that interact really interestingly with some of the more canonical stuff that they're reading. Or that when we're looking at canonical stuff, I draw out some of the more subversive elements for them to kind of think about.
You know, when I was thinking about your work, I wondered if, because there are also discussions here in school districts about whether reading lists add anything, right, to the student experience mm-hmm. anymore. And I've done shows about it. People feel very strongly about it. You know, do you believe that reading the Dickens and the classics that these girls probably have to read to graduate from high school is mm-hmm. necessary today when there's so much other experience to be aware of and a reading list might crowd that out?
I think that it's really important that young people are reading things that reflect the breadth and complexity of the world that they are living in now. And that's not to say that students shouldn't have an understanding of and a respect for and an appreciation of the literary history at all. But I think it really does young people a disservice if you're telling them that the contemporary moment that they live in is not worth thinking about because you're not including the texts that actually reflect their world and the things that they're reading. So I think there's a balance to be struck between, yes, giving young people a kind of solid understanding of the kind of literary greats. But I think it's really important that we enable young people to understand their world and critique it by giving them access to texts that talk to them about their world.
It really goes back to what we were saying a few minutes ago about literature can tell you things about your world that journalism
exactly.
can't.
Exactly. And that is the way that I think about literature and the way that I hope I teach literature is that texts are the beginning of a conversation. That's what they're there for. It's not meant to be a kind of instruction manual for life. They're meant to offer you ideas to explore and chat about, I think.
Michael, I can't wait to read what you write next. Hope you'll come talk about it.
Thank you so much. I'd love to.
Michael Doncor's new novel is called House Girl. I'll tweet about it. Read it.